This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. You know, it's been a mediocre decade when we can't even agree on what to call it. But whether it's the aughts or the noughts or the 2000s or the I decade, the first 10 years of the 21st century have abounded with lousy ideas. Contributors to the Washington Post recently compiled a top 10 list of the worst ideas of the decade. Their list runs from the dangerous to the annoying to the inane. In the last 10 years, BlackBerry devices took control of our lives. Sports seasons lengthened beyond all reason. Movies trended toward the "we aren't so different after all" theme. And don't forget about torture memos and TV dance competitions. The list goes on and on. Oh, what a decade it was. We'll talk with some of the masterminds behind the Post list, and you can find a link to the piece at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the hour, Hank Stuever on the sheer size and scale of Christmas. But first, a supersized edition of the Opinion Page, the worst ideas of the decade. And we want to hear from you. What was your worst idea of the decade? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. We start with Dahlia Lithwick. She's a senior editor at Slate.com. Her pick for the worst idea of the decade, the torture memos. She joins us now from her home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what made the torture memos the worst in your mind?
Well, it was a tough choice. I confess that Dances with the Stars never was on my top.
You defend the reality dancing craze.
With passion. But I, you know, it was very tough to, as a legal reporter, to isolate the moment in the, quote, war on terror that things really went south. I mean, certainly you can make a strong argument that Guantanamo was the worst moment, or very, very broad theories of executive power or indefinite detention. So I had a kind of large menu to choose from. And I settled on the torture memos because I thought they were unique in smoking out really the worst parts of the legal war on terror. I mean, they showed the complicity of attorneys, how attorneys could help twist and bend the law to make that which is absolutely prohibited by domestic statute, by international treaty, somehow negotiable. And I thought that was really toxic. I think it went to what was really wrong with the president's own advisors, who were supposed to be standing up for the Constitution and the rule of law, and instead were essentially saying, you know, do you want fries with that, sir? And giving the president not only everything he asked for without qualm, but really not even pushing back at all as a legal matter. So to me, I think it really said the legal process broke here and broke here in a way that's almost irreparable. And also, I think licensing torture took us to a real new low that even had we, you know, gone through with Guantanamo, had we gone through with indefinite detention, it seems that when we became a nation that tortured and that could condone it with what looked like logical legal analysis, that was a moment from which there was no turning back.
You believe it's almost irreparable?
Well, I believe that unless we do much, much harder work at investigating what went wrong and why it went wrong and holding the people that were instrumental in the architecture of this legal thinking to some kind of account, I think we really are looking at the possibility as a nation of doing it again sometimes in the future and saying, as we did last time, well, these were exigent circumstances, everybody was freaking out, and that makes it okay. Unless we really, I think, draw a line on this and say, this is where we have gone too far. I think it is incredibly likely that torture is now on the menu in the future.
You say that the memo sort of represented the lowest low point in post 9/11 legal thought. Was there a lot to choose from, in your opinion, of low points in that time period?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there were, and I think there was just a general sense right from the outset that by framing it as a war on terror after 9/11 and refusing to believe that any of the existing legal mechanisms, criminal legal mechanisms that we knew had worked, you know, including criminal trials for terrorists, including legal interrogation, you know, we had interrogation mechanisms that were vastly superior to torture, and lifelong interrogators have said and continue continue to say, torture doesn't work. So why is it that we resorted to ideas that were really bad ideas? And I have to say Jack Bauer, 24-driven ideas, instead of a whole set of mechanisms, criminal mechanisms that we knew worked. So to me, I think the entire notion of framing it as a war instead of as a crime really set us on the wrong track.
What I find so intriguing about this list is that it does encompass things as serious as you say, from the moment we became a nation that tortures to fashion mistakes. And I noticed that you were on a live chat with the Washington Post earlier today, and someone said Crocs was the worst mistake of the decade.
That was on my short list. You know, not only did I vigorously defend Dancing with Stars on the Washington Post live chat, but I defended Crocs only because, as the mother of small boys, the idea that I don't devote 4 or 5 hours a day to lacing small shoes really, I think, liberated me to be the journalist I am today. So I can't really be opposed to Crocs. I did think some of the things on the list that were a little frivolous or sounded a little frivolous had some truth to them, including our being enslaved to Blackberries, and including just generally reality television. I can't tell you how many Washington Post chatters wrote in just enraged about the fact that we have become a culture that watches other people you know, endlessly and obsessively, simply because those other people are married to guys with lots of money.
Let's hear from Tanya in Madison, Wisconsin. Tanya, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. You know, it's funny because she just kind of touched on it. The whole idea of reality TV kind of took over the old genre of soap operas. But additionally, I'd like to say there seems to be a whole new element of very young people being very cool. Don't know if it happened with the whole Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, all the boy bands that, you know, started getting really popular in the early 90s and then just kept going with Hannah Montana and all those other people. But it just seems like, you know, these 12 and 13-year-old, you know, kids are very cool nowadays.
Are you sure it's not just that you got older, Tanya?
You know, it's quite possible. I'm still in my 20s, so I'd like to think I could remember back that far. And I certainly wasn't nearly that cool at that age.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
We are talking about the worst ideas of the decade. We'd like to hear what you think was the worst idea you had this decade. Give us a call at 800-989-8255 or send us email talk@npr.org. My guest is Dahlia Lithwick. She's a senior editor at Slate, and her idea for the worst idea of the decade in the Washington Post collaboration was torture memos. We're also joined by Nick Gillespie. He's editor-in-chief of Reason TV and Reason.com. His choice for the worst idea of the decade was the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Nick Gillespie, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, a law from 2002, not necessarily a obvious choice. Why did you pick it?
Well, I try to be unpredictable, but among other reasons, it was suggested to me by the Washington Post. But let me immediately expand the object of my scorn into a slightly larger topic, which also tracks somewhat with what Dahlia Lithwick was talking about. But it's not just Sarbanes-Oxley, but the bipartisanship that we were told we really desperately needed in Washington throughout the aughts. Bipartisanship tends to give way to legislation which is not overwhelmingly passed, but is really idiotic. And here you can think about things like the Patriot Act, the No Child Left Behind Act, which was brokered by Ted Kennedy and George W. Bush, the authorization of force in Iraq, which went through like nobody's business, or more recently, just a year ago or a little bit more than a year ago, the TARP legislation, which is I think everybody, virtually everybody outside of the Beltway recognizes as a big disaster. Sarbanes-Oxley, an accounting bill that just completely rejiggered the way that publicly traded companies are supposed to report on their accounting practices, has had absolutely no upside other than that it's a full employment act for accountants who really rarely are begging for business anyway. It basically has had only negative effects across the board. It has made it much more difficult for smaller companies with harsher accounting requirements to compete with bigger companies that can absorb those costs. It has not, according to the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, done anything to minimize fraud or fooling around with financial statements. They've actually said that they've seen more mismanaged accounting statements and fraud going on after Sarbanes-Oxley was passed. And it also hurts companies that have to comply with Sarbanes-Oxley versus ones who don't. Keeps companies private, which deprives them not only of capital, but of investors of possibly investing in publicly traded companies. So overall, just a bad, hysterical piece of legislation that doesn't accomplish its basic goal.
Well, you talked about, you know, that these bills tend to be bipartisan and not get a lot of dissent, and you just called it hysterical legislating, which also, you know, is the context. So this was passed in the wake of Enron and other scandals.
Right. Tyco, Adelphia, WorldCom in particular. And there's always a sense that, you know, we have to do something. The Patriot Act is probably the most serious bit of legislation in this vein, and also one of the most telling, where it's a bill that everybody knows, and, you know, if you listen to people who were there, like Congressman or former Congressman Bob Barr, nobody had any time to read that legislation before they passed it. Something which, again, is replaying right now in healthcare reform. Whatever you think of healthcare reform, there is something deeply, deeply troubling with the notion that it is becoming increasingly common that legislators pass massively long, transformational pieces of legislation without even taking the time to actually parse through them. Very disturbing.
We are talking about the worst ideas of the decade. Let's hear from Parrish in Charleston, South Carolina. Parrish, what's your worst idea?
I'd say the urban SUV, to kind of modify the SUV a little bit, but the fact that everyone in every city that I've lived in for the past 10 years now drives an SUV. I hadn't even heard of them 10 years ago.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you on the SUV hating, although I was sort of jealous of the people who had them this weekend.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's created almost a driving culture, a road culture, to where you need one. I've heard my friends defend their purchase of an SUV in that you have Escalades and Hummers on the road and they don't want to be in a Prius that gets crushed by one, which I can understand. But it's definitely been a scourge on the decade. So.
Parrish, thanks for your call. We'll get more of your picks for the worst idea of the decade in a moment. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can also reach us by email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Rebecca Roberts. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. We're talking about the worst ideas of the decade. The Washington Post compiled a list in their Outlook section in the Sunday paper. TV dancing competitions made the list. The BlackBerry, too. It's spiraled out of control, according to John Freeman. You can read the full list through a link on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And what about your worst idea of the decade? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And we should say at least some people in our audience think that one bad idea is talking about the end of a decade when technically it has not ended. We have an email from Jonathan who says, why can't we get it right and realize decades, centuries, millennia, etc. do not end until the first day of years ending with a one? There is another year left in this decade. It drives those of us that are mathematicians nuts. So, Jonathan, we're sorry. You are right. We are going to continue to talk about the end of this decade, acknowledging that we could perhaps be 365 days off. We are talking with Dahlia Lithwick. She's a senior editor at Slate. Her choice was Torture Memos for the Washington Post compilation. And Nick Gillespie, he's editor-in-chief of Reason TV and Reason.com. He wrote about the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And Nick Gillespie, what were your runners-up?
Well, you know, one of the things I was just going to say, based on the email you just read, if we've got another year in this decade, I am incredibly depressed. This is really about the worst. I think this is my fourth or fifth decade. My math skills are bad, but it's certainly been the worst of mine. On a serious note, I think virtually any of the big bipartisan pieces of legislation that I mentioned at the top, I mean, whether it's the Patriot Act, No Child Left Behind, the coming The TARP bailout was tremendously awful and will continue to diminish our economy, I think, for decades to come, and sets a terrible legislative precedent as well. On lighter notes, on much lighter notes, you know, I think that the rise both of the bowl college system, as well as the constant threat and, in some ways, congressional threats about having a college football playoff are horrible ideas. And more prosaically, I think the tyranny of hardwood floors across
America.
Oh,
really? Are you tyrannized by hardwood floors?
I am absolutely tyrannized by hardwood floors. And in my house in Ohio, which I bought a couple of years ago and was told that there was just subfloors under the unbelievably gross carpet, I recently picked up a corner, and lo and behold, there is hardwood there, which I'm going to be digging out over the next couple of weeks. But what I dislike about it is that we all need to have hardwood floors if we don't have tile or slate or something even more expensive and exquisite. What people always fail to recognize is that fashion choices are, by their very nature, superficial and are not any more windows into the soul than Putin's eyes are for George Bush into Putin's soul. And, you know, I grew up in an era in the 60s and 70s when wall-to-wall carpeting was the sign that you had made it. Only farmers and poor people at hardwood floors. That wheel of fashion has turned once again, and now it's all about exquisite teak and parquet and whatnot. And I find it a bit tedious. I'm looking forward to you know, the day when wall-to-wall shag carpeting comes back in a big way.
As are we all.
Yes.
Dahlia Lithwick, would you agree with Nick Gillespie that this has just been one of the lousiest decades?
Not been a great decade. Had the Post asked us to say what was the best idea of the decade, I think it would have been a much briefer feature. I probably don't agree with Nick on the hardwood floors, and I'm just going to suggest inviting a group of toddlers over and just have them sort of race around, and they'll polish it up right quick. Our hardwoods are as slippery as ice because of years of my kids sliding and slipping and dropping grape juice on it. So I think there are cheap and effective ways to make hardwood really slidey. but I don't think that this has been a decade that there's an enormous amount to be proud of. And I say that even as we watch the decline in journalism, too. I think that I'm not sure that journalism has really acquitted itself brilliantly in this past 10 years.
That journalism has not done well for itself, or that the industry as a whole is over with?
I think both. I think clearly the industry is scrambling to reinvent itself, but I'm not sure that that we've done our very, very best to be great journalists in this era.
Let's take a call from Andre in Toledo, Ohio. Andre, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Hi there. Well, I got to say my thunder was a bit stolen. I was going to mention the BCS college football ranking system. But since that has already been brought up, I could say the second worst idea of the decade was Congress deciding to weigh in on the argument. So in December of 2019, we'll still be talking about the BCS and what a worthless kiss-your-sister type of issue we have here.
Andre, thanks for your call. We also have an email from Nick in Madison, Wisconsin, who says, in my opinion, the worst idea of the decade was the concept of outer space tourism, culminating with the idea to send Lance Bass into space. To me, it sums up both the unfortunate fads of the decade and the ridiculous economic speculation. I think the recession has really put that one in perspective. We're also joined on the line now by Clive Thompson. He is a contributing writer at Wired, and in his Washington Post column, he wrote that vaccine scares are one of the worst ideas of the decade. He joins us from his office in New York. Welcome to Talk the Nation.
Good to be here.
Why did you choose vaccine scares?
Well, I thought that this is an example where a patently unscientific idea gained really enormous currency and had real-world effects. I mean, the example I cite in my piece is that the question of why didn't the government have enough swine flu vaccine this fall at the outset? Well, one of the reasons is because the feds decided not to put adjuvants in the vaccine. Now, adjuvants are these something that can boost the immune system. And in Europe and Canada, they typically include this in the vaccine because it lets you stretch your vaccine further. You don't have to put as much in each syringe, right? So if they'd use adjuvants, they could have had four times as much swine flu vaccine enough to probably cover the country. Why didn't they put it in? Because they were worried specifically about the anti-vaccine movement attacking them, because the anti-vaccine people think adjuvants might cause autism. So if you want to know why there wasn't enough swine flu vaccine, it was because that is how powerful the anti-vaccine movement has become. Even though there is really no solid proof at all linking vaccines to autism, it has begun to regularly deform government policy. I think that's that qualifies it as a horrible, horrible idea.
So it wasn't necessarily that they feared a particular reaction from this ingredient in the shots. It was that the confidence in the vaccine is so important to make sure people get it that
absolutely,
they needed to
absolutely, yeah,
have
because
the right PR.
Vaccine people are very vocal about scaring parents about this stuff. And so, you know, if the government's thinking, well, we could make more of this vaccine, but what if people don't take it, you know, and their backs are up against the wall, because that's how powerful this lobby has become.
We are talking about the worst ideas of the decade. Let's hear from David in Las Vegas. David, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. My worst ideas were staying in the market at the peak of the stock bubbles and their subsequent decline.
Oh, David, I think you probably have a pretty big support group on that one being the worst call of the decade.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Boy, would I be in good shape if I had gotten out at the peak and then gotten in at the bottom. But if I could only time the market, then I wouldn't have to work.
Well, you do live in Las Vegas.
This is true, and I don't really gamble either, except on stocks, which are supposed to be more of a sure thing, definitely more of a sure thing than a casino. But I'd be way ahead in my retirement savings if I would have been able to time the market.
David, thanks for your call. It's interesting, you know, David referred to something last year. Most of these ideas have been sort of in the latter half of the decade. And is some of that because we have short memories, or did the decade start off strong, do you think? Dahlia Lithwick?
One of the folks who wrote into the Washington Post chat made that point, that 2000 was no picnic, and the Mark Rich pardon was nothing to smile about, and there were a lot of horrible ideas before 9/11. But I do think, at least in terms of my viewing of things through a sort of a legal prism, certainly I think 9/11 was a game changer. And so, you know, the things that started to happen in 2002, 2004, 2005 in relation to the war on terror were really a whole new degree of awfulness. And so I can look back to, for instance, Bush v. Gore and say, well, that was a bad idea that happened in this decade. But it just doesn't seem to be on par with the things that I've been talking about here today in terms of unitary executive or unlimited indefinite detention for no reason.
Well, to second that, we do have Ed in Warren, Michigan, who says the Y2K debacle has to be in the top 10, although at least by our mathematical standard, that was not in this decade. And Shannon in San Francisco says dangling Chad gets my vote. With this, we saw our election process hijacked, the unprecedented involvement of the Supreme Court, which then ushered in the fearful 8 years of George W. Bush. We are turned now. Let's see. We've got Michael in Boston, Massachusetts. Michael, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, I realized that actually the Iraq invasion was a worse idea than what I thought of. But speaking of George W. Bush, when you promulgate or at least give lip service to an ideology that says that government can't do anything right and that the free market can basically solve everything, then the people who get into government seem to be the people who don't really care about getting it right.
So free market capitalism?
As an ideology, it's a useful technology, but it's a really great engine, but it's a good idea to hook it up to a drivetrain and some wheels and to have someone driving.
Michael, thanks for your call. Nick Gillespie, do you agree with him?
I don't, as a matter of fact, because one of the things that and I wrote about this the day after George Bush left office for the Wall Street Journal, George Bush was in no way a free market capitalist. He was the biggest expander of government since Lyndon Johnson, which is the only the oldest benchmark we have, because they changed the way that the government accounts for its budget in the mid-60s. He increased government spending, discretionary and mandatory government spending, by 100% in real terms. And that, unfortunately, he seems to have greased the skid for the current executive. Bush also passed more what are called economically significant regulations than any president in recent history, meaning regulations that cost the economy more than $100 million to implement. What we, you know, there's no question that Bush and his handmaidens in the press, his supporters as well as his detractors, all pretended that he had something to do with free markets and with capitalism. In fact, he didn't, which I think is most clearly seen in both in a variety of policies he pursued throughout his presidency, but then in the TARP bailout. There's an easy free market solution to what happens when companies fail, which is that they go into bankruptcy, such as GM and Chrysler. They could have gone into bankruptcy without government support, and everybody in the long run, and actually even in the near run, would have been better off.
I want to run through a bunch of these emails. Jesse says giving Obama the Nobel Prize is his pick. Aaron in Portland says canceling Day to Day, which was the single best show on NPR. Sorry, guys. And what kept me as a young listener coming back every day to listen. Here's a shout out for you, Nick. Todd says, as a consultant who profits from it, I have to wholeheartedly agree with Sarbanes-Oxley. And this is one of many emails that echo this sentiment. This is Gabriel in Oakland. Why hasn't anyone mentioned the Iraq War? So let's start with you, Dahlia Lithwick. Why didn't you choose the Iraq War as your worst idea?
You know, it's interesting. When I did the live Washington Post chat this morning, that was the, I think, overwhelming amount of mail said this list can't possibly have not included the invasion of Iraq. And I think that probably this is what happens when you ask 10 people for the worst idea. Everybody thinks the other 9 will have picked the invasion of Iraq. So, you know, I think it just somehow slid through the cracks. But certainly, I think an awful lot of us, if you'd polled us again, would have put it on our list.
Clive Thompson, do you agree?
Yeah. I mean, I think the Iraq War was a catastrophically bad idea. Moreover, it was sort of the beginning of this problem that it's sort of like an problem that affects a lot of things. The thing I talk about, vaccines, it affects other things, which is a retreat from the idea that facts sort of matter, you know what I mean? And that we can agree upon the facts. It used to be that Clay Shirky, a thinker here at NYU, said, you know, there's been this very strange thing that's happened sort of epistemologically in the last decade, which is that facts used to nail down an argument, and now facts just start arguments. So the question as to what was really going on with, you know, weapons of mass destruction and whatnot, it sort of became, you know, in the aftermath of the Iraq War, this really fraught issue. A lot of people literally arguing whether they were there, they were not there, and the idea of whether or not we should actually nail down these questions and answer it has just sort of boiled away. It's become a very common response to a lot of very difficult questions. You see it with global warming, you see it with the vaccine stuff, you see it with intelligent design. Everyone has a cherry-picked set of facts and no desire to actually commonly hammer out what the jointly agreed-upon facts actually are.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Nick Gillespie, we'll give you a crack at that one, too. Why didn't you choose the Iraq War?
You know, partly I did mention the authorization of force in Iraq in my Washington Post piece. And one of the things that's fascinating is that invading Iraq and in the immediate flush of victory there or mission accomplishment there, you know, this action had something like 80% approval ratings from the United States. Certainly more than 80% of American legislators voted in favor of invading Iraq and staying there indefinitely. You could also, I think, wrap in realistically the Afghanistan mission, which immediately became unclear as to what its objective was once we lost the trail of Osama bin Laden. It has not been clarified whatsoever by Barack Obama, despite the fact that he has increased troops by about 100%. Since the beginning of this year in two announced increments. One of the things that is worth asking the American people, and I say this as somebody who was against the Iraq War before John Kerry had voted for it and then voted against it, is where were you when this was going on? I agree with Clive that it's worth thinking about facts. Facts are always Facts, though, are never really fully settled. They are merely kind of the endpoint of a previous argument or a previous claim. And it might be that we have entered an age where, just as everybody is able to kind of program their own media and program their own environment to a degree that was unthinkable even 20 years ago, people can now program their own reality so that facts become more slippery. I would like to argue on some level, or at least in some cases, that that's actually a very liberating thing. And it's one of the few good things that has happened over the past 10 years is that, ironically, even as all of this horrible things happen, particularly in the political sphere, I think, it is true that people are, even in the diminished circumstances of an economic recession, we are more able than ever to live our lives the way that we want to, in terms of lifestyle, in terms of social pressure, in terms of inventiveness, in terms of recreating work, at least those of us who have jobs, and 90% of us still do.
Well, we have to leave it there. Nick Gillespie, editor-in-chief of Reason TV, Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate, and Clive Thompson, contributing writer for New York Times Magazine and Wired. You can read the whole top 10 list at NPR.org. We give the last word to Brian in Oklahoma City, who says, while I commend the man who dreamed up the millionaire idea of punching two holes into an airline blanket and fashioning the orifices with sleeves, this idea has made giant adult bibs into a fashionable staple of the American sofa. Cheers to you, evil snuggy man. It's Talk of the Nation.